Kia ora, welcome to Emirates Podcast, episode 331. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, 2017. There's been a lot of news that's been going on in New Zealand over the past, well, past 6 weeks, actually, most of which I haven't had a chance to talk about on this podcast. And today I'm going to fix that, because they've been big stories here, which have probably been not any story at all in most of the rest of the world. So chances are you may not even have heard of any of this stuff. So, and even if you have, you can hear my perspective. So I have news and sport. And first, we'll talk about sports. Yes, it's true. I know it's really weird that I should be talking about sports, because I'm not a fan of sports of any sort. However, the two biggest stories are both about sport, and they both have significant implications, I guess, for New Zealand as a country. The first is that New Zealand has again won the America's Cup Yacht Racing Series and is bringing the America's Cup back to Auckland again. And it's probable that most people have never paid any attention to America's Cup, certainly not this year, perhaps not any other year either. A lot of people have this impression of the America's Cup as being a rich man's game, because it used to be. Nowadays, it's more of a corporate game because corporations sponsor all of the teams. The Team USA was sponsored by Oracle, and Team New Zealand was sponsored by Emirates Airlines. So the teams were known respectively as Oracle Team USA and Emirates Team New Zealand. Although in this country, nobody used the Emirates name. They just called them Team New Zealand. Be that as it may. The series this year was run in Bermuda, and of course New Zealand ultimately won it, and will be bringing the cup back to Auckland. Now, Australia was the first country ever to win the America's Cup away from the USA, and then they lost it, and New Zealand won it in 1995 and brought it to Auckland. And when I first emigrated, I used to tell people that I was coming here to keep an eye on the America's Cup. And it's fair to say that most people even then had no idea what I was talking about. But it was a big deal here. And the defense, which was successful the first time that a country that had taken the America's Cup had successfully defended it, generated nearly $1 billion all up in economic activity for Auckland and New Zealand. And the second series in 2003, together the two series generated something like $2 billion in economic opportunities, which is a big deal for a small country like New Zealand. The 2000 series, the first defense, and 2003 in particular, spurred the development of an area of Auckland called Viaduct Harbour, which is now a premier waterfront location with cafes, bars, restaurants, hotels, all sorts of amenities. It's a really nice place to go if you ever come to Auckland, by the way. And so the race series itself may not interest people, but what it does for New Zealand and for Auckland is a very big deal. It also has spurred interest in New Zealand boat building and design and boat building, which has generated hundreds of millions, perhaps billions by now, of economic activity for New Zealand as well. So it's a big deal because of that. It's a big deal because it benefits New Zealand in a lot of very tangible ways. This year, the helmsman on the Team New Zealand boat was a 26-year-old named Peter Burling, who has become the youngest person ever to win an America's Cup, the youngest team member ever to win an America's Cup. And he and another team member, Blair Tuke, who's 27, won gold at the Rio Olympics in sailing. And so there was a lot about them, and a lot of the team members are really quite young. And so a lot of people focused on that, and the sort of thing that pundits always say at a time like this about how New Zealand punches well above its weight on the world stage. And it's true. I mean, in this case in particular, because it was pluck and determination that carried them through the day. They didn't have the money or even the technological resources that, say, Team USA had, but they pulled it off anyway. And so it's actually kind of more or less true in this case, but it is a tired cliche. It really is. I did blog about this, and I'll include a link in the show notes, which talks about all this stuff, but also has links to various things. The other thing that's been going on in New Zealand has been the British and Irish Lions Tour. Now, this is rugby, and a lot of people outside of, well, Commonwealth countries and a few other countries in Europe probably couldn't care less about rugby. But it's the national game of New Zealand, without a doubt. And so it's a very big deal here. And every 12 years, a combined team of from the United Kingdom and from Ireland come here to play rugby. And what's interesting about that, well, there's two things. First of all, normally the home countries in the UK have separate teams. There's Wales, England, and Scotland all competing in the Rugby World Cup. And they actually do other test matches as well. Ireland, however, competes as one team for the entire island of Ireland. The four provinces of Ireland are together in the Irish Rugby Football Union. And the football union started before Ireland was partitioned. And after it was, they decided that they would keep the union together. But that raises a problem. Because they're two separate countries, and they have two separate national anthems. The national anthem of the Republic of Ireland is called the Soldier's Song, which upsets people who are pro-unionist in Northern Ireland. And the national anthem of Northern Ireland is God Save the Queen, which upsets people who want to unify Ireland again. And so in 1995, the Irish Rugby Football Union had a song composed called Ireland's Call. And this song has become the substitute, I guess, national anthem for the Irish team whenever they play at the World Cup or other events outside of Ireland. When they play in their home ground in Dublin, then they play the Irish national anthem followed by the first verse and two choruses of Ireland's Call. And this is what the final chorus sounds like. Ireland, Ireland, together standing tall, shoulder to shoulder, we'll answer Ireland's call, we'll answer Ireland's call. Now, I'm a proud All Blacks supporter, but I have to tell you, when you hear that ringing out through a stadium, it's really quite stirring. The only thing I can think of that really is very close to that is when the Welsh are playing, especially if it's in Cardiff, and the stadium practically vibrates with the sound of the Welsh singing their national anthem. Even though I don't understand the words, it's nevertheless really quite stirring. But I bring it up because it's a very unusual thing for two separate countries to come together in one sport team and to have a special anthem that they sing to that acknowledges their separateness and yet connectedness. And it's pretty special in that regard. None of that was the case this time, however, because it is a British and Irish combined team that tours New Zealand, as I said, once every 12 years. And so what they do is they play a bunch of games around the country and three test matches against the All Blacks. So this time the games were against the New Zealand Provincial Barbarians, about which more in a minute, the Auckland Blues, the Canterbury Crusaders, the Otago Highlanders, the Maori All Blacks, the Waikato Chiefs, the All Blacks, then the Wellington Hurricanes, then the All Blacks again, and a final match against the All Black, a test match against the All Blacks, just recently on July 8th, this past weekend. And the results were mixed. They beat the Barbarians, they beat the Crusaders, they beat the Maori All Blacks and the Chiefs, and they beat New Zealand on July 1st. But they lost all the others, or they drew, depending on which one it was. But the only thing, I mean, I didn't watch any of the matches, so I can't comment on any of them. I don't watch rugby on television much of at all anymore. I used to all the time, but I'm not a sports person, and so it just doesn't really interest me that much. However, I just want to say a couple of things about that. First, the first match was against the New Zealand Provincial Barbarians, and they're basically a kind of an auxiliary team or something, often made up of former All Blacks and other players that haven't been in the All Blacks. And part of what it does is it helps sponsor school-level rugby. So it's sort of a fundraising charity sort of thing that it does. But not exclusively, because they've played internationally in the past. But the one thing I wanted to add is that Wikipedia has an article about them, as it does so many other things, and it says that their nickname is the Babas. And it spells it like the sheep, you know, B-A-B-A-A-A, or something like that. Only, I don't think they've got that right, because the word, the nickname is derived from their name, obviously, the Barbarians. But in the New Zealand accent, Barbarians is more like Barbarians, sort of like that, because they don't pronounce their R. Well, they do pronounce their R's, but they're so soft that it's very hard to pick up. And I think whoever said that Baba was the nickname probably is perhaps an American or Canadian or something like that who can't hear the R and assumed that it was Baba. And I am pretty certain that what people are actually saying is Barbar. Only, as I said, because the R is so hard to hear, it sounds like ba-ba. But, yeah, I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure, having lived here for 21 years, that it's ba-ba, not ba-ba. And that's about the best I can do with my mongrel accent. But the other thing I wanted to mention was the Māori All Blacks. Until 2012, they were known as New Zealand Māori. And the name was changed to Māori All Blacks primarily because they are of a equivalent grade, or whatever you want to call it, to the national side, the All Blacks. Now, to be in the Māori All Blacks, they have to be able to provide their whakapapa, or genealogy, which is checked to make sure that they really are Māori, because in the past, apparently, some people who looked Māori or were actually Pacific Islander were on the side. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. Now it's just Māori. Now, a lot of the players are on the All Blacks, or they become eventually part of the All Blacks, and they tend to be quite good. They have beaten the British and Irish Lions in the past, although they lost this time. And what's one of the things that's interesting, they began in the 19th century, so it's, you know, nothing new. However, what is interesting about them, I think, is that they were the first rugby side in New Zealand to wear the black jersey with the white silver, what, the white silver fern, which is now the uniform of pretty much every sporting code, including the All Blacks. And they were also the first sporting side to perform a haka before the start of the match, which, of course, is now associated with the New Zealand All Blacks, but most other sporting codes do a version as well for test matches. And so they have a long and proud history all their own. And there were issues during the apartheid era in South Africa because South Africa didn't permit mixed race teams to tour the country. And so the All Blacks had to leave the Māori players out of the All Blacks if they were touring South Africa. And that's a whole story in itself, the whole tortured story of rugby between New Zealand and South Africa during the apartheid era. But that's a whole another topic, and one I'm not going to get into today. But this is something that has dominated New Zealand for months, really, because they were talking. The anticipation of the tour was the main topic of conversation in the evening news and in the chat shows and so on. And might have even been live coverage of the announcement of the touring side to New Zealand. I can't remember that part, but it certainly was covered in the news. And then, of course, when the matches were on for the month, basically, that it was on, that got coverage every single day on the evening news, something. By all reports, the British and Irish tourists who came to New Zealand for the match loved their stay here. They loved their time here. They loved the people of New Zealand, as one would, of course. And it was apparently good for the New Zealand economy, though we don't know any of the details of that yet, because the final totals aren't in yet. But it has been a very big deal for New Zealand, and it still is, because the final match is just this past weekend, so they're not entirely done talking about it yet, and probably won't be anytime soon. which from my perspective is a bit of a shame because I'm not a sports person. And because I'm not a sports person, that's all I'm going to say about sports, but I am a politics person, and as it happens, there is political news that is in the news. So that's good for me, I think. The latest is that last night, the One News, which is from TVNZ, released the results of the latest One News Comar Brunton poll, and it was terrible for Labour, which is the main party of opposition. They're at their lowest level for the leader for 8 years. And where do I begin? Well, first of all, about that part. The pollsters have always done this thing they call the preferred prime minister. And it's basically a popularity contest between the leaders of the various parties. And I think people are able to suggest people that they want to see as prime minister as well, who may not be a leader of a party. For instance, Jacinda Ardern, who is the deputy leader of the Labour Party, is polling 1 point higher, I think, than the Labour leader, and opposition leader, Andrew Little, is. For instance, and that's quite common. But the I think it's a bit barely interesting, personally, because we don't vote for the prime minister; we vote for the party, and the leader of the party goes along for the ride. And so, whether a particular leader is popular or not is kind of irrelevant. If the party wins and the leader of that party becomes prime minister, then invariably their personal popularity goes up. It always happens. However, the counter argument to that is that if a leader of a party is personally unpopular, it drags down the entire party. That certainly happened in the 2014 elections when David Cunliffe, who was the leader of the New Zealand Labour Party, was personally unpopular and in the general public, and that helped keep New Zealand Labour Party's votes down in the general election. So that could be something that could happen again. I mean, we just don't know. But he's been leader for 2.5 years, and he's just not connecting with New Zealand. And I'm not entirely sure why. He's very bland, but then so is Bill English, who's the current Prime Minister and leader of the National Party. So that alone can't be it, and I just don't know what it is. Now, I will say that I didn't support him becoming leader. It wasn't my first choice, I mean. And when he became a member of parliament on the party list many years ago, I didn't like that idea because I thought that he would eventually become leader of the party, and I didn't think he was going to be a good leader. But then there are other people that I don't like, too. I mean, he's tapped this guy named Greg O'Connor, who was head of the Police Association, which is a union, basically, and to run against Peter Dunn in the Oahu electorate, which is in the Wellington area. And if Peter Dunn is defeated, then his vote to support the National Party government will be gone. And one of the problems with the next part of the poll I'm going to talk about, the party rankings, is that for some reason in New Zealand, the news media almost never polls on electorate races. And I can understand that for the two parties, for Labour and National, because how many seats they get in Parliament is dependent on their share of the party vote, not which electorates they win. So that kind of makes sense. But there's two electorates where they should be polling heavily, and one of them is Oahu, and the other is Epsom, where David Seymour, who's the leader of the ACT Party, is in there by the grace of National doing a deal with him. And I don't know that he's going to have a serious challenger this time, but I know that in Oahu, the Green Party is not standing a candidate to give Greg O'Connor a clear run. And if that happens and the center-left vote isn't split, then that means that Peter Dunn may be out of Parliament. Or he may not, because he's recently come out in favor of decriminalization of marijuana and other drugs too, apparently. And after years of adamantly opposing that, now all of a sudden he's for it. So that's a vote grab, I think, and it could be enough to keep him safely in power. Now, all of that matters because on this polling, a National dropped to 47% and Labour dropped 3 points to 27%. And both the Green Party and New Zealand First were up 2 points to 11%. And the Māori Party is up 1 point to 2%. And the Opportunities Party, which I'll have to talk about at some other time in more detail, is steady on 1%. Now, you have to get 5% of the popular vote or win an electorate seat in order to get a seat in Parliament. And with the Māori Party and the Opportunities Party both polling well below 5%, they must win electorate seats or they're out of Parliament. Now, the Opportunities Party, which is run by economist Gareth Morgan, who's probably better known in the world for wanting to ban cats, seriously, he is not in Parliament, and I don't think that he's going to get his party to 5%, even though he's going to spend a lot of his own money. I just don't see it happening. But, you know, anything could happen. Who knows? But based on the current polling, on this current poll, there would be a parliament of 122 MPs, which is two more than normal. It's called an overhang. And National would have 57 seats, which is not a majority. But if both the ACT Party guy and the United Future guy, Peter Dunn, and the Māori Party all get back in, with their current number of seats, then that would give them four more seats, bringing them to a total of 61, which is still not a majority. So they would either have to get the support of New Zealand First and its 14 MPs to form a government, or Labour, the Greens, and New Zealand First could form a bloc and also have 61 seats, which also wouldn't be a majority, but they could force a hung parliament. Now, who would run the country if there was a hung parliament? I don't know. I would suspect it would probably be the current government would stay in power, but I don't know that. I don't know if things are different here than they are in, say, the UK, where there's a hung parliament, but the Conservative Party held on. It's really difficult to say. But the poll was conducted between July 1st and 5th, which is after the America's Cup victory, and that reinforces my earlier statements that the America's Cup victory would not help the National Party at all, and it hasn't. And I didn't think it would. But the bottom line in political science, what the cardinal rule is in political science when it comes to evaluating public opinion polls is that you don't look at specific numbers in the polls. You look at the trends in those polls. And you have to compare apples to apples. So you have to compare one brand of poll to the same brand of poll, not to different polls. And the movement is what determines ultimately where things are likely to go. Now, things can change. There's still the better part of 2 months until the election, more than 2 months. And anything could change. Anything could happen. And it's entirely possible that this whole situation will be flipped all on its head if there's some scandal or something. But barring that, the polling indicates that the Greens and New Zealand First are going to be doing better, and Labour could do worse than it's doing now, and so could National. Now, who ends up forming government is anybody's guess at this point, but it would be difficult for New Zealand First and the Greens to be in government together. And as I said last time, New Zealand First and Labour have been in government together, a stable government that lasted for quite a while. And the Greens could stay outside of government and just provide confidence and supply to the government. But that kind of depends on National not getting enough votes to get anywhere near a majority, and probably on losing one or two of their support parties. And all of this is going to become clearer as the weeks progress, because they'll be doing more polling. Eventually it becomes, I think, weekly as the election draws nearer. But the important thing here for the people hoping to bring down the government is that neither Labour nor its leader are doing well. And it's entirely possible that Labour is doing poorly because of its leader. I don't know. I do know that its policies so far have not been connecting with ordinary New Zealanders, even though they're arguably better than National's announced policies. And that's not just in my opinion. It's based on the polling I talked about last time about issues that people care about. But they've been problematic. Their immigration policy is kind of dodgy, and they've had some other issues that also haven't been haven't been too good for them. So I don't know how this is all going to shake out. Nobody does. Anybody who says that they know how this election is going to turn out doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're lying. Could be for propaganda purposes. But if I were to guess at this point, I would say that National may pull out a fourth term. But there is so much water to go under this bridge that I can't say that with any certainty. And I think it is also possible that there could be a change of government with this grand, this sort of big coalition of Labour, the Greens, and New Zealand First. I don't know. Nobody knows. But you will know as I find out things, because I'll share them here on this very podcast. And naturally, I will provide links to a lot of this stuff in the show notes at amrenspodcast.com. So if you want to read more about these topics that I've talked about, feel free to go by. And hey, feel free to leave a comment. People don't do that much anymore. But it's nice. We used to, in the old days, we used to have lovely conversations on comment sections of podcasts and blogs and all that. But it seems to be a bit of a dying art. But that's it for today. And it's cold, and we're about to get a real cold snap here, so send me warm thoughts. But that's it for today. I will be back soon, clearly. Well, not clearly, but I will be. Bye. You can comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at amrenspodcast.com, where you can also leave a voice message. You can send me an audio message through Audioboo or Skype, where my username is Amrens, and you can email me, with or without a voice message, at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrenspodcast.com. This podcast is recorded and distributed under a Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.